This week's Parsha is Vayera. We have Bereishis, we have Noach, we have Lecha, Vayera, fourth Parsha of the book of Bereishit. And the Parsha in general continues with the episodes of Avram's life, starting at the ripe old age of 99, and goes all the way to next week's Parsha, which will be when his wife passes away at 127 years. That make him 137 years. So we get a 37 year piece of his life over five chapters in the book Parsha Vayera. Okay, we're going to deal with one of the numerous stories. So I'm going to. Okay, so we're going to. I sent everybody the class like about 20 minutes ago. I forgot to include it earlier, but don't worry if you did not, because I will screen share it. Okay, so I'm going to. Class called Romeo and Juliet and Avram and Sarah. So I'm going to begin the class. And for those who know, I'm going to start with a video, because everybody likes a video, which I'm going to connect somehow or another to the class. So here we go. The movie Romeo and Juliet, the play by Shakespeare, Romeo and Juliet, you should be somewhat familiar with. We're going to get the last minute, the scene, the quintessential scene. I'll catch you guys up, and then we'll discuss it. Here we go. This is a more modern version of Romeo and Juliet with none other than Leonardo DiCaprio and Claire Danes back in 1996. Here we go. Does everybody see the video screen? All right.
Yes. Good.
All right. Yes. The audio is not super loud. I'll do my best. You tell me if it's whatever. Here we go. All right, I apologize, the audio is not so loud, but there wasn't that much audio to begin with. So just everybody, just to refresh everybody's recollection about Romeo and Juliet, at that scene, Romeo, played by DiCaprio, takes poison because he believes Juliet is dead. And then the next scene is, of course, what happens to Juliet?
She kills herself.
She kills herself, correct. She stabs herself. All right. When she sees that Romeo is dead. Now, Romeo did. Why did Romeo kill himself?
Romeo kills himself because let's go back to ninth grade English.
Rabbi, you know you're still screen sharing, right?
I'm brushing my hair right now. I just want to make
sure Rabbi Penny knew he was screen sharing. That's
you,
all.
You see the sheet?
Yeah. But I also see it in my email. I just want to make sure you knew.
Yeah. No, I'm purposely doing that.
Okay,
basically, Romeo kills himself because he can't be with Juliet.
Correct. And now, what did Juliet do that he thought that she was dead? Who remembers that? For 500 points in the square.
She killed herself?
She did not kill herself because obviously she was alive there.
Right, but when she realized that he was dead, she killed herself.
No, but he thought that she was dead because she had taken a drug.
Took something with the help of like the priest or something like that to have them run away together.
That knocked her out for 42 hours because she wanted to get out of that, to get out of being stuck in a marriage she didn't want to be part of.
Right.
Okay?
Yeah.
All right. That's the basic, that's your basic Wikipedia catch-up. All right, that's all you need to know. So the question is, what level of value do Romeo and Juliet place on romance?
The highest level of value, even before life.
That is correct. Clearly, you know, which is question number two, why would they commit suicide if they could not be together? What is their belief?
It's better to be dead than to be apart. On his side, it's he can't live without her. And on her side, it's I can't live without him and I don't want to be stuck in this marriage that I don't want to have to be in.
Correct. Okay. Now, would Romeo have been willing to sacrifice himself to rescue Juliet from danger?
Yeah, of course.
Now that, but no, that
I know was, where you're going with this.
But that's a little bit different. Because that means that he knows that she's going to be alive, but he wants to protect her, but even if he's going to endanger himself, would he do that?
Well, he doesn't want to live without her. That doesn't mean he doesn't want her to live without, that he wouldn't be okay with her living without him so long as she survives. Those are two very different things.
Correct. They're two different things. That's why I'm asking that. So what do you say? In other words, if her life was in peril,
yes,
would he endanger himself to protect her?
I think so.
First of all,
there's no guarantee. Him endangering himself, there's no guarantee that it kills him.
Correct.
But if he thinks that her life is in danger, he may legitimately think if he doesn't at least take a chance and potentially endanger himself, he's guaranteeing that she dies.
Correct.
So I go yes.
So, okay, that's a very strong argument. Everybody, do you agree? Do people agree with Jesse?
Yeah.
I do. Sound argument.
I do. Oh, hi, Taryn.
All right.
Hi.
All right. Now, is it romantic for a husband to give his life in defense of his wife and children even if he cannot rescue them?
Not according to Jewish values. But
I didn't ask. Well, slow
what
down.
Do you mean?
Yeah.
I'm not talking Jewish values. I'm asking, is it romantic? That's not the same thing.
It's romantic, but not wise. Because you can't change the outcome.
Okay. So, why is that romantic?
Well, but you just said even if he does it, you can't save them?
Because he can't live without them.
Because even though he knows it's not going to work and that it's definitely not going to happen, he's still taking a chance because even though he knows in his heart it won't save them, he's going to take any chance he can. And if he's unsuccessful, he doesn't want to be without them anyway, so let them all go.
So that, of course, begs the question is, you know, what is romance and why is that romantic? What's the idea of, you know, this romantic idea or ideal? That even if I'm going to endanger myself, or even if I'm going to, if my wife and kids are I have to defend them, I'll lose my life, even if I can't necessarily rescue them. What is the definition or idea of?
Well, you just changed your own question there. You just said, even if I can't necessarily defend them, which is very different than even if he can't rescue them. Because the idea of necessarily means that there might be a shot.
Either he can, but in both cases, both gestures would be defined as being romantic.
Okay.
It's a chivalrous act to show his love for them.
So what is it? What is the idea behind? What does it mean? What is that idea? What is that? Where does that come from? I mean, not where does it come from? What is the principle behind this, you know, romantic idea, or you say this chivalrous ideal?
An undying love.
So why does that have to do with me endangering myself?
Till death do us part.
To death do us part. All right, but then she's gonna die. So now it's over. Right.
Yeah,
we're having the love, and now she's dead.
I would say that it makes me think of you're showing that you recognize that their life is your life without them is simply not the same. And that you're willing to lay down yours to save theirs.
Am I just stating
the obvious?
But what? So in the romantic perspective, what is the highest value or the highest good?
To lay yourself aside for someone else's betterment.
Well, that's just one expression. You know, the romantic gesture does not mean you have to die for it.
No, but it's the ultimate form of, I would give this for you, I would give that for you, I would give anything for my beloved. The ultimate sign of that is, I would give everything I am and put everything on the line to protect you, I would think.
So that means that, according to that ideal, what is the highest good of life?
Self-sacrifice
is the currency of what you'll demonstrate or what you will give in exchange for that good. It's not the good itself.
So the ultimate good is saving a life. Is that where you're?
Well, I mean, so would you say that a paramedic who goes and is a firefighter goes into a burning house to rescue a person, is that a romantic act?
No, there has to be an intimacy or love behind it.
So what really is the person showing? What ideal or idea is a person showing by doing these dramatic gestures, even as much as laying their life down?
Love.
It's sacrifice.
Well, sacrifice is, I'm saying sacrifice is not the goal. The goal is not to kill yourself. The goal is that my ideal or my putting on the pedestal the abstract value of the love of this person or this idealization of this person is the highest value, even so much that I'll do what? I will give my life to protect it. You know what I'm saying? I mean, is that what we're saying? Is that the romantic value? That my beloved is so valuable, it's such an important notion that I'm willing to even risk my life, even lose my life. And the reverse is, and living a life without my beloved is not worth living. Is that the romantic ideal?
I would say it's not.
It's not? So then what is it?
I think it's a fairy tale.
No, that's something that you're dealing with. A separate question is it true? Is it not true? Is it valuable? Is it not valuable? Is it a virtue? Not a virtue. The question is whether you agree or disagree with, you know, of the idea or ideals of chivalry or these romantic ideas. We're gonna get to that. My question Is that what the idea is saying? The first question is, what is romance? You know, we're just trying to get a definition. And question, if you agree with it or not, is romance is the idealization of my beloved to the degree that they are the highest value, that nothing is more important than that. And therefore, I'm willing to lay down my life for my beloved.
I don't think that's what romance is. I think that, yeah, I just don't.
Okay, so then what is it?
I think romance is the ability to love someone that you would put yourself before them. But once we get into the whole killing ourselves sort of thing, I think that's a new category.
Right, but the whole idea of it is that it's taken the idea to the extreme. It's the, of course, no one thinks someone else should die for their romance.
Right, but the Romeo and Juliet, which is a quintessential example of the romantic ideal, that's what they're basically saying. That, you know, Romeo felt that a life without Juliet is not worth living. And then, of course, when Juliet sees he's dying, life without Romeo is not worth living. And therefore, she commits suicide. They both commit suicide. Double suicide. I mean, is that not what's happening? Yes, no, maybe, kind of.
It's exactly what's happening, and I know how you're going
to. It's a commitment to another person, but it's the ultimate commitment to another person. But it's not the same as saying that you put this person above all other things, because in theory, maybe it's what you're getting at. You shouldn't put another person above God, but I don't know if that's kind of where that's going to end up looping in your thought process.
I'm just first trying to identify. Regardless of the other implications, the question is, what is this value system?
I think to an 18-year-old, this might be like the ultimate pinnacle of romance. But to a mature adult, it would probably seem pretty foolish.
Well, that's a follow-up question. The question is, given that system is what it is it wise? And Taryn said it's not wise. She said that already up front.
But I wouldn't necessarily say foolish the same way, because you hear stories all the time of people who have been married for a long time. One person dies, and very shortly after, the other person does as well.
So oh, right, but that's very different than someone killing themselves for the sake
of. I mean, but that also happens too, and we've seen stuff in the news and stuff like
right.
that happens.
And
as well.
You could argue those people are really foolish for killing themselves for the sake of someone else. That's it.
I would say more selfish than foolishness, possibly, but okay.
So there are two issues here. Let's say you have a couple who've been living together for 60 years. So their life has become so interconnected one from another, psychologically, they don't have the wherewithal to go through the difficult years of, you know, old age without their life partner. You know what I'm saying? Which may not be the same thing as saying that they view them as the highest good. It's just that on a functional, utilitarian level, psychological level, they just can't do it. You know what I'm saying? You know, life has become very just too painful. And in a certain sense, they sort of lose that extra will to go through the last difficult years, which is old age. You know what I'm saying? So, you know, it's more of a psychological reality than a philosophical value. All right. The reason why I bring this up, because we have a very seemingly not romantic gesture going on in this week's Parsha. Actually happens in this week's Parsha, and the Torah spends a little more time on last week's Parsha. So I'm going to scroll down to that. All right, this week's Parsha, who would like to read? It's chapter 20, verse 1. All right, Shmuel, read it out.
Sarah and Abimelech, chapter 20, verse 1. Abraham migrated from there to the land of the Negev, and he settled between Kadesh and Shur. He would often visit Gerar. There he announced that his wife Sarah was his sister, and Abimelech, king of Gerar, sent messengers and took Sarah. God came to Abimelech in a dream that night. "You will die because of the woman you took," he said. "She is already married."
Okay, stop. All right. Why did Avram announce that she, Sarah, his wife, is in fact his sister? And the episode will be back in last week's Parsha. Why is he doing that? Anybody know?
Because if they thought she was married, they may try to make her a widower so that they can then go after her more legitimately than if she was still married.
That's 100% correct.
Yeah.
In fact, Avram is more explicit when they go on their first journey out of the land of Canaan. They go have to migrate down to Egypt. Let's have Taryn read it out. Chapter 12. This is the last week's Parsha. Trouble.
Sorry, there was a famine in the land. Abram headed south to Egypt to stay there for a while, since the famine had grown very severe in the land. As they approached Egypt, he said to his wife, "Sarai, I realize that you are a good-looking woman. When the Egyptians see you, they will assume that you are my wife and kill me, allowing you to live. If you would say that you are my sister, then they will be good to you good to me for your sake, and through your efforts, my life will be spared." When Abram came to Egypt, the Egyptians saw that his wife was very beautiful. Pharaoh's officials saw her and spoke highly of her to Pharaoh. The woman was taken to Pharaoh's palace. He treated Abram well because of her, and Abram thus acquired sheep, cattle, donkeys, male and female slaves, she-donkeys, and camels. God struck Pharaoh and his palace with several plagues because of Abram's wife Sarai. Pharaoh summoned Abram and said, "How could you do this to me? Why didn't you tell me that she was your wife? Why did you say that she was your sister, so that I should take her to myself as a wife? Now here is your wife. Take her and go." Pharaoh put the men in charge of Abram, and they sent him on his way along with his wife and all that was his.
Right. So this week's Parsha is really the second time this thing happened. So please, who can explain to me Avram's thought process of dealing with his wife who was beautiful?
Well, he wanted the reason he did it was to sacrifice. He didn't want her, he didn't want, he would be killed and then she would be taken captive and then nobody would win in the end. So just like Romeo and Juliet, it's the highest, I guess, form, if you're comparing, and it's the highest form of sacrifice because he knows what's going to happen. So it seems messed up that he says that as a sister and lets them whatever, but it's to protect both of them.
Can I just say that?
Yeah, Shmuel.
This reminds me very much of, I don't know if it was last week or the week before, but Noah blames everyone else, all the wrong people for his problem. And this sounds very similar where Avram does something kind of tricky and then the Egyptians take the brunt of the punishment for something that they don't even know about.
Right.
So that's one. Two.
Before we get into the blame game, what is Avram's strategy?
To save his life.
Not only to save his life.
And save her life?
Well, she's not going to be hurt no matter what. What is going to be in both scenarios until God gets involved, quote unquote? In the case of Avram going down to Egypt to Paro's empire, or going into Gerar under Abimelech's empire, what's going to happen to his very attractive wife?
She'll be taken away.
Yeah, she'll be taken by the Egyptians.
Taken away, what does that mean?
Like, she won't be killed, but she won't be his anymore.
What? Okay, we're not being clear. What's going to happen to Sarah or Sarai?
It would be, she would be
married off to somebody else, yeah.
Right, wed to some Egyptian.
And he
not
he
just
doesn't want
not just Egyptian. She would be put into Paro or Avimelech's harem to become what they call a concubine, right? Married to that king and to be part of his sexual entertainment, correct?
Yeah.
Okay. So she's going to be, you know, having to be sleeping with either Paro or Avimelech. Any way you go, either outcome, right? Either Avram is dead and she has to be in the harem, or Avram's alive and she's in the harem, right?
Right.
Okay. Now, are we clear with that? So her outcome is the same until God helps out. So Avram says to Sarai, do me a favor. What's the favor?
Pretend like we're not married.
Say we're not married. I will function as what?
Your brother.
Your brother.
Your brother. Now, what will Paro, in fact, do? Which, in fact, he did do.
Spare his life if he's the brother, and kill him if he's the husband.
And gifted him many, many, many things.
Yes.
Made him a rich man, yeah.
Made him a rich man. 12:16. He treated Avram well because of her. Avram thus acquired sheep.
I'm guessing all that stuff.
Donkeys, male, female, or in order, because since he's now going to be the brother-in-law, married into profound wealth, you know, into royalty, it's only appropriate that he share a dowry with the only available family member, which is brother Avram. Correct? So, of the two choices, she's still going to the harem, A, and Avram is now part of the royal court and becoming wealthy. So, first question, romantic or not romantic?
Not romantic.
Not romantic.
Big time not romantic. In other words, Sarah, you're going, you know, things are not going well for you, and I have I cannot fight the entire Egyptian empire.
And Romeo would have tried.
Right. Now, why couldn't he stay in Canaan? Let's look at all the scenarios. Why couldn't he stay in Canaan?
Famine.
There's a famine. There was no food. So let's go through the possibilities. If they stayed in Canaan in relative safety, they're all dead. So that's not an option. They go down. Why is there no famine in Egypt?
Because they're an advanced civilization and they know how to store food?
No. I mean, maybe, but that's no. They have a bigger advantage.
The Nile?
Yeah, the Nile. They know, even if there's no rain,
they can always fish and stuff.
They have the capacity to irrigate their crops from the power of the Nile. So they're a society which is not perfectly, but is more famine-proof than the land of Canaan. Okay? So Canaan, no food. Food in Egypt.
When he left... Canaan and went to Egypt, did he know like this would ultimately happen, or was this kind of like he showed up and he was surprised?
No, Taryn read it nicely. Verse 11. As they approached Egypt, he said to his wife Sarai, I realize that you're a good looking woman. Now, was it? Now he's been married for her for decades. What do you mean he just realized she's a good looking woman? What do you mean I realized you're a good looking woman? He's married to her at this point, he's about 75 years old. And she's 65, which, by the way, she's a very good-looking woman for 65 years old, obviously. Which is another question. Why was it so important that Sarah was, you know, an amazingly attractive woman, even into, you know, at 65 years old? Now, that's a separate question. What does it mean, I realize you're a good-looking woman? And when the Egyptians will see you, they will assume that you are my wife and kill me, allowing you to live.
I mean, he's lying, right? Of course, what? Like he always know. Like he's lying.
Well, he does lie to them, but no. But he's having before they get to the Egyptian border, he's having. We're getting a little.
Well, like you know, like he's been they've been married for like so long. I mean, of course, he knew that she was beautiful.
So why is he saying that?
It's an acknowledgement.
Did he get Taryn Gadd?
Sorry, it's an acknowledgement more than a realization.
And therefore, what? Why is he bringing that up right now?
Because he knows what's going to happen.
Right, because her beauty is a liability.
And it's also, well, so it's a liability, but it's also like a positive thing because does he know
no,
that?
In other words, if he went down there and she looked like a really old woman and nobody's going to look at her twice, is there a problem?
Nope.
No.
So they both go down, two elderly people, two senior citizens, go down from Canaan and they buy food and they live in Egypt to wait out the famine. But the conflict is that Sarah is, she's older, but she's super attractive. And if you're super attractive in a tyrannical world where people can just essentially take you and apparently, now why don't they just take care and have her be, and even if she's married?
Because then he'd be dead.
What was the morality of Egypt that Avram perceived? This is very important to get all the... You got to unpack the story in practical terms.
Pretty despotic.
So if they're despotic and tyrannical, so why do they care? They can just say, we don't care if she's married to you. We're taking her anyways.
It's their custom or something?
Apparently, so they have some sort of like a taboo that they will not bring into the harem somebody's married.
Or it's always easier to keep your harem happy. So right. If you kill her, well, you'll still have her, but she won't be happy. But if it's a sibling, well, we can make her happy because her brother's happy or her sister, whatever's happy, her family.
Right, could be all the exactly. So the bottom
happy
line
life,
is
happy life.
That's true. So, but this is the reverse. In other words, no wife. The fact that she is unmarried makes it uncomplicated. Versus married, it might cause a revenge, it might cause a problem. So the rule is only unmarried women into the harem. Fine. By the way, what other story later in the Bible, which centers around a holiday, does the exact same thing happen to?
Esther and Mordecai?
Esther and Mordecai. And interesting, there is a Midrashic tradition that Esther was in fact not merely adopted by Mordecai, but they were married. But the difference was that God did not perform a miracle for her, and she went into the harem and ultimately became Achashverosh's chosen wife and never left. Okay, now.
Ouch.
Yeah, that's so. Let's go now. So let me ask you the first question: was Avram right in doing this?
Yeah, I guess the ends justify the means in this case.
What? Explain.
Well, by. If he would have said that they're married, he's taking an enormous gamble and hoping that it works out. But by
One second. So Shmuel, if he felt that if he says, if they would have announced they're in fact married, what was he convinced would happen? What was Avram convinced that would happen?
They would have disappeared him and taken his wife to Pharaoh.
Yes, they would have made Sarah unmarried by basically putting a hit onto Avram.
You broke up with the rabbi.
So let me review. In other words, Avram was convinced, obviously knew the Egyptian and by extension the society of Gerar, both societies, that they're immoral societies, that in order for them to get Sara, if they know that he's married, they would make him magically unmarried by giving him
so basically, you
know, concrete kind of, shoes, and Avram would be in the bottom of the Nile. They would have whacked him.
So it's like, isn't it kind of like the cowardly thing to do? Like, I'm going to save my own life, but like, listen, for a few years, you're going to have to be with the Pharaoh for a while, but
hold
I'm going to be.
On, hold on 1 second. What was Avram's expectation walking into the situation?
That they would just pass. You know, they would let them
through. Well, hold on. If you enter into Paro's harem, how long is that for?
Life. His expectation was he was border. He was basically selling his wife to another man, actually forever. For a really sweet dowry of the, it would look like at that point.
So right. So is he setting ours? So I go to my. I repeat the question again. In other words, Avram's expectation was A, there would be no miracle, and that he would have to say goodbye to the love of his life, and she would be taken into Paro's harem, and he'd get to see her. You know, he'd be able to have a brother-sister relationship. You know what I'm saying? He'd have a what they call a platonic relationship. But then as a husband and wife relationship will be completely gone. So obviously that's devastating.
Yeah, because, I mean, she didn't really get a vote in this, right?
Yeah, it's deeply unromantic.
you say it's devastating, Rabbi, but he was like, yeah, okay, this is what we're going to do so I can survive.
It sounds selfish, yeah.
But at the same time, I think you have to consider that it's so that they can both survive because they couldn't stay where they were because of the devastating famine. So they had no choice but to be there.
Correct.
No, yeah, so, but like he's going to survive a lot nicer than her. I mean,
true. You know what I mean?
Like
he is basically selling her into a glorified form of slavery because that's probably what being – not even probably. That's exactly what being in the harem was. Like, that's – I mean, it's not – well, it's working, but different work. It's – yeah, that's – I stand behind that statement.
Right. I mean, she's not going to be asked to wash dishes. She's going to be – just has to be available sexually for the Paro when he wants her.
Forever.
Forever.
Or until he gets sick of her.
Correct. 100%. Yeah. And the same thing happened to Esther.
But I feel like – he's not a romantic guy. She probably knew this. You value, you know, sometimes you date a person and it's not because they're romantic. They're smart or, you know, he's not a romantic guy. I feel like she knew this.
Okay.
Not marrying a romantic guy is very different than
being sold off into slavery.
Thinking I married a guy who's going to sell me off to slavery to cover his own ass.
But I feel like I appreciate his strategy.
He's a survivor. Like,
right. What's the point of us both being killed or me being killed? I mean, I appreciate his strategy here.
So the question is we have to ask the first question. Is Avram acting properly here?
No.
Who says yes and who says no?
I say no. I don't know.
All right.
I wouldn't do what he did.
Okay. All right, so who says he acted properly? Who says he's acting improperly?
Romeo definitely would have let himself be killed.
Did what he had to do. Like, okay.
For who, though? But he did what he had to do for who, though? He did what he had to do for himself.
No, don't you understand? We're not talking about like rational people here.
No, no, I know, but I'm saying you said he didn't do it. But the question is,
they would have whacked him and then kept her for what they wanted to keep her for.
So you're saying the father of our religion was an irrational, crazy person?
I think they're extremely rational people in an irrational situation.
I think he's borderline hyper rational.
Yeah. Hold on.
All right, so. By show of hands, raise your hand if Avram is acting justly. Raise your hand if you think he's acting justly. So Amanda says he's acting justly. Yeah,
scroll through the camera.
Can you stop this, Sean?
And Suzanne. All right, so Sean, who's also here for the fourth cycle, Suzanne and Sean are keeping me honest here. I cannot repeat two classes here. So Sean, why do you think that Avram is acting justly? Go ahead. You're on mute still for some reason. Try again, Sean. We can't hear you. You're still on mute. We hear nothing. Maybe your mic is not, you're on the wrong mic. Sometimes it happens. All right, we're going to go to, all right, Suzanne, why do you think you're saying that Avram acted properly? Why?
Well, the outcome for her was probably going to be the same. And he would be of no use dead. So, I feel like he, given the information he had, he made the best decision.
Okay.
I mean, what was he going to do dead?
Right. All right. So Suzanne's argument is that if I try to, I try to fight or I announce that we're married, I'm dead. If I say I'm a brother, I'm alive. And in both cases, Sarah ends up at the same place. So what's the advantage of me being dead? Okay, that's what he's arguing is. And not only that, not only will I not be dead, but actually I'll be put into a good situation. Instead of being dead, I'll be now part of the royal court. All right, first of all, does everybody agree that's his argument? Does everybody agree that's what Suzanne's saying? Does everybody agree that's Avram's thought process here? Yes? No?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, next question. Is that a good line of thinking?
No.
Why not, Jesse?
So I'm going to take a different side route to this argument, but look at the hypothetical from her side once she's in the harem. If he died, if he was killed because he was her husband, in theory, one of her thought processes might be, you know, yes, my husband died, but he died, you know, defending me or, you know, proclaiming his love for me. And that happened. He knew it was a possibility and it happened. At least now in theory, she can also potentially move on because her husband is now dead. On the other hand, the way it played out, because without God's intervention, because they didn't know, as far as I know, that was definitely going to happen.
Correct.
She could have been living for the next however many years. You said she was 60 at the time, and she made it to 130-something. So 70 years in the harem, knowing that her husband lied, and he's out there living the good life with all of the stuff that he was given by lying to Pharaoh, and she's still there and seeing that he's happy and free. And if he's free, he can get remarried too, for all we know. Like she just sees it piling on. The potential is there for it, is all I'm saying. Not saying it's definitely
100%, but sure he can.
It could happen that way.
Okay, so.
Can I respond or not?
Also, me after.
All right, Amanda, then Shmuel. All right.
That's you don't understand that this was not like a civil society. She wouldn't have time to think that her husband was a hero. They would be like raping her and exploiting her. And I used to think this like way too. And then I started studying this portion more and I realized that it's easy to judge in hindsight. You're not dealing with rational people. Like she like is going to be a slave to Pharaoh and then that's it. There's no more Jewish people.
But that was happening to her regardless though.
No, this prevented her from being.
But we didn't know that, though. We had no way of knowing that.
Right.
He was telling her to be constantly raped by the Pharaoh and living in the harem. As far as I know, nothing in the Parsha says, prior to them getting to the land, God spoke to Abraham and said, as long as you tell her to pretend that she's your sibling,
very shortly I will scare the shit out of somebody and get you guys freed and then she'll be okay.
Correct. So
they both went into it. He went into it selling her that way, where knowing that all that terrible stuff was going to happen. She went into it knowing he's going to say he's my brother. That way he is not murdered, but all of this is going to happen to me. So that outcome for her was, as far as we know and as far as anyone knew at that time, guaranteed. There was no avoiding that.
Guaranteed. Okay. Shmuel.
I'm not sure how you could really argue that he didn't have the right line of thought, because we have the privilege of hindsight, so we see that he made it out. I mean, whether he made the right choice or not, they ended up with a win. Like, they made it.
But we're not. No, I'm not asking that question, because again, that's okay. They didn't know that. I'm saying, was that? I asked everybody the question: did Avram act properly? So Suzanne responded. She says yes, because the outcome for Sarah is the same, whether he protests or not. And the fact that he's now acting as the brother, he gets to live, and not only live, but apparently live well. And so that's the best choice. So he acted properly. He's no value to anybody if he's sitting in the bottom of the Nile. Jesse responded back to Suzanne saying, well, you know, why is that right that now Sarah's in the harem over there, and knowing that Avram is living the life of Riley while she's basically a sex slave. Why is that fair? Is that your basic point?
It's not fair. He took.
Yeah, I call him a coward in this case. Well, not saying in general Avram's coward. I know he did so many things. In this particular point, he took the coward's way out, in theory.
He took a big gamble, and it didn't pay off.
Right. So the question is, in other words, to fight, to, it, was there
any... I disagree. I think he did something. He tried.
Yeah, I think...
If he would have just went into it, then they both would have been doomed. He tried. Yeah. He loved her enough that he tried to make up the scenario. Maybe it was like 10%
self. He tried to cover his ass.
No, this is what people mean. This is what people mean by... Sorry, go ahead.
In other words, the question is, is this a situation, because in last week's Parsha, we see that Avram, to save his nephew Lot, does a midnight raid together with his 318 men, his militia, and does a midnight raid and is able to defeat four regional armies in the middle, you know, using the benefit of a surprise attack at night. So Avram, apparently, you know, he's courageous and willing to take on risk to save his nephew, but is there any? But he doesn't seem to be so courageous here. He's just saying, "I'm a brother."
This is what people mean by discretion is the greater part, like the better part of valor. Like, this is the intelligent thing to do, aside from being murdered on the spot.
Correct. And his wife. So there's a value of being courageous when you have a chance, but you're not going to fight the entire Egyptian army. That's called no chance. So I wouldn't call him a coward. I mean, it's not being a coward if you're not willing to, or it's not being a coward if you're, the fact that he's not willing to commit suicide, essentially, is not an act of cowardice. So I would argue this is not that romantic. This is not romantic at all. Zero. And the truth is, you know, he's really, the goal is, because the romantic life with Sarah, which is a nice part of life, it's clearly in his value system not the highest value. And it's better to live than to be dead. And, you know, better to live than be a dead hero. And you wouldn't be a hero. You know, what you would call that, a hero.
Now, can I ask,
yes, God.
Like, what was his life like when she was in the harem? Was he like, did he go crazy? Like, that would drive me crazy, knowing what's happening.
So obviously, the Torah does not, because first of all, he was only, she was there, because it says As soon as she shows up, God struck Paro and his pals with severe plague because of Avram's wife Sarai. So as soon as she shows up, they're having a major problem. So there wasn't much time, but
she wasn't in the harem for a long time, is what you're saying.
No, it was like, but obviously, when he is, you could imagine that when he says that, oh, I'm her brother, and she's being taken away to Paro's palace, right? He does not know that God's going to intervene. He does not expect a miracle. Okay, by the way, which is a very important point. If Avram does not expect a miracle, we should not expect a miracle. You know what I mean? That's, I think that's a handy-dandy thing to remember. All right? The Talmud says that those that expect a miracle don't get a miracle. Okay? So we don't aim some chral nes. We don't rely upon miracles. So Avram thought that when he was saying goodbye to Sarai, that was going to be for a long time. I mean, he would get to visit her because the brother or sister. But obviously the anxiety, the tormenting thoughts about thinking that this despotic king, Paro, is going to be sleeping with her, obviously was a painful thought. And he has to act as everything's great. Like, oh, there's gonna be a great simcha. There's gonna be a wedding. Yay! You know what I mean? So this is a tremendous, terrible thing. One, in fact, counted as one of the 10 trials of Avram. Anyways. But
so can I just build off of the miracle comment?
Yes.
Briefly. So just the paragraph before, God appeared to Abraham and said to your offspring, I'll give you this land. Yes. So Abraham had the promise from Hashem that he was going to become a great nation.
Yep.
And I feel like he kind of forgot that and then took things into his own hands. So, I mean, Hashem's kind of saying,
what he was probably realizing, assuming that he had realized that that promise was true, he thought that perhaps his future children are going to come from his wife Sarah, and then he said, I guess he's realizing it's not going to happen. In fact, after the story in this week's parsha of Abimelech, after Abimelech takes her and then gives her back, Sarah does become pregnant with Yitzchak. Yitzchak is born in this week's parsha. So his initial thought, and also in last week's parsha, even when he gets Sarah back, she's still infertile. And what does Sarai give to Avram to start to kickstart the Jewish nation? Anybody remember? What does Sarah give Avram to kickstart the Jewish people?
She lets him have Ishmael with her.
Well, she gives him her maidservant, Hagar, and say, you'll have a child with her, and I'll raise it. She'll be a surrogate mother. Okay? All right? So it doesn't mean that he was denying the covenant. He just really thought that the covenant's not going to be through his wife, Sarah, which ultimately turns out to be wrong because she does end up producing Yitzchak in this week's parsha. So we got a little time left. I want to go to a classic statement from the Talmud. It says like this. Rabbi Kiva explained. Everybody see this?
Mm-hmm.
When a man and a woman merit it, Hashem rests his divine presence between them. Okay? Rashi says, merit it, going in the proper path of fidelity. His divine presence, he's divided his divine name, making it dwell between them. Yud. In Ish, or the Hebrew word for man is Ish, Aleph Yud Shin, okay? And Isha is Aleph Shin He. So when they merit it, Hashem rests his name, in other words, the Yud and the He, the two last letters of God's name. If they do not merit, a fire will devour them, since Hashem will remove his holy name from between them, making the word Ish Isha. You take out the yud from the man's name of Ish, what do you get? Aish, Aish is fire. Take off the hay from Isha, you get Aish. Obviously not a literal thing, but it's trying to teach us a point here. And what is that concept? That if the couple is acting properly, what is the highest ideal that they're trying to accomplish in their relationship? To have what rest in their relationship?
Godliness.
Okay, what does that mean? That means that the highest principle of their household is not their love one to another, but ultimately is to reflect the values, the ideals of a home, which is a God-centered home, which is to have a home where kindness is performed, where charity is performed, where kids are raised in a proper manner, where there's respect from one each other, okay? So that, and if it's not that, if God forbid the couple uses the home as a platform for each person to try to suck out the emotional and romantic value from the other, purely selfish endeavor, then as Rashi says, fire will devour them, because once the godliness is removed, once the yud and the hay, the godliness is removed, they're gonna, you know, consume each other. Because basically that's the source of, what is the source of couples fighting? Each person looks at the marriage as a vehicle for their own personal satisfaction. Stereotypically, let's say the woman is constantly wanting to go shopping. We can use a stereotype, right? So she's constantly taking the family, you know, credit card and charging up, you know, tremendous amounts of expenses, regardless of the well-being of the family's finances, because she doesn't care. She's there. She married this guy for her to finance in part her dream. Or conversely, you know, the guy's only interested in her essentially for the sexual romantic component. Not really beyond that. So when he will tire from her, what will he do? Or what is he liable to do?
Cheat and grow resentful?
Yes. Cheat and grow resentful, or grow resentful then cheat. One of the two, right? Correct. So that goes into the whole point. In other words, romance plays a role in a healthy marriage, but we see from the extreme case of Avram, it's not the highest ideal. What Romeo and Juliet did was really, from a Jewish standpoint, is basically insane. If you're Romeo and you see your beloved, you know, wife has died, I mean, it's a terrible thing. And we sit Shiva, and there's proper mourning, and there's honoring of the dead, but you got to move on. Conversely, if Juliet sees that Romeo has died, you know, you got a new life. You know, it's devastating. We have, how long is mourning? We have Shiva. And then we have a 30-day period for husband and wife. And then you move on the best you can. Only for parents, you have a 12-month period of mourning. That's in respect to the institution of honoring your parents. Now, I bring this up. What's the relevance to you guys, to all of us, is that in our society, we are affected by these romantic ideals. What does it do? What it does is it makes people, when they're dating, that no girl or no guy becomes good enough. It prolongs the dating process because, I went out with this girl and Rabbi, you know, I didn't feel anything. In other words, there was no orchestra in the back. There was no, angels. You know what I mean? The expectations, because of the romantic ideas, make the bar so incredibly high that it makes people recognizing what really is truly valuable, what makes a successful marriage unreachable. Conversely, when people go into marriage and they have these romantic ideals, which are unrealistic and unwise, therefore, what's it going to be a source of? Disappointment, disenchantment, disrespect, and divorce. So there's a place for romance, but if it becomes exaggerated, becomes the highest value, it leads to either not making a decision on anyone. In other words, nobody's good enough for me to get into a relationship with, A. Or conversely, it holds back the marriage from blossoming. They had an interesting study where people who describe themselves as being madly in love with their spouse to get married, how long does that state of euphoria of being madly in love last into the relationship? How long does that last? You know, the couple, like, and they're saying, you know, they're like talking in baby language, like they're annoying to be with. How long does that last typically?
Six for months. A couple?
What?
6 months.
6 months is correct. Now, what happens to it?
It fades away.
Why does it fade away?
Because it's like a house built on sand. It's not stable.
Why is it not stable?
Because those are fairly superficial.
Exactly.
Than reaction.
What's superficial about it?
Because you're just like, oh, you're so beautiful. Like, I'm in love with you. It's not like, you know, you make me happy or anything like that.
And everything's new.
And baby talk, eventually you realize it's stupid. I say that out loud, my bad.
So the bottom line is because the fantasy gets punctured. In other words, going back to our definition, what is romance? Romance is that I view the person as being the ideal. There's only one problem. Nobody is the ideal. We're all imperfect. So it can't be true. It just takes some people about 6 months to realize that. What's an intelligent reason to get married? One is that A, of course, I'm attracted to them. B, I enjoy being with them most of the time. Not all the time, because everybody's a little bit annoying, myself included. Three, they could be a good father or mother to our children. Four, we share the same core values. And five, we are good at working through conflicts. Those are the ingredients you need for a successful marriage. The romance is a nice bonus track, but it's not ultimately the wise criteria for making a decision. And Avram in our Parsha recognized that having a dead Avram is not going to help anybody. And Sarai, who unfortunately, because she was beautiful, nearly, if it wasn't for divine intervention, was going to pay a very big price. She was going to be taken anyway. So Avram says, so why should, you're going to be taken anyways. Either I could be dead or I could be alive, and we can have some relationship. In other words, true, we will not have the husband-wife relationship, but we'll still have the brother-sister relationship, and we can still talk, and we can still schmooze, still visit, there's still value in that, and that's it. And, look at the remaining part of the blessings of life without saying, well, if I can't have the ideal, I might as well just kill myself. There's a lot of valuable, wise lessons here. Even though, since we're so trained to see things toward the chivalrous and romantic ideal, but ultimately, as going back to what Taryn said, the first point, that's not wise. Your husband dies. You don't have to. You should not kill yourself. Even though emotionally at that moment you feel like, oh, how could I live without that person? The reality is, it is very difficult, and there is an idea of grief. And it does take a psychological journey to transition out of that. Not so simple. But that's our you know, the highest goal is to be to lead a meaningful life, not to be a slave to a romantic ideal. And that's some of the lessons that I think this particular episode teaches us. Any questions? Shmuel. You're smiling.
What do you recommend for someone who's extremely foolishly romantic to not do those things?
I mean,
wait before you drink the poison.
Correct. In other words,
wait 5 more minutes.
Just 5? Okay. Right. No, I mean, there's a place for that. You know what I'm saying? You know what I'm saying? But it's not, be more specific. Like, you think what, I mean, I think people like romantic gestures. It's just not the, in other words, to write little notes and to give gifts. And to express your love and appreciation to your your beloved is a very nice thing. It's sweet. In fact, I would say it's a good thing because it adds a goodness and a vitality to the relationship. But it's not the highest good. You know what I'm saying? There's a difference between something which is good versus the highest good. You know what I'm saying? I'm sure Avram maybe took his wife, you know, when things were normal. You know, they went out for dinner. You know what I'm saying? Whatever the equivalent of going out to dinner in the land, you know, in the Near East.
2000 BC.
Whatever that was back then. You know what I mean?
Right.
So doesn't mean it's purely utilitarian. You know what I'm saying? There's a difference between pure utilitarianism versus absolute romanticism. You know what I'm saying? There's a huge journey.
You know what I'm saying? Yeah, certainly.
So the Torah does not generally advocate an all or nothing approach here.
It's just, I currently do.
What?
No, nothing.
Like Romeo and Juliet did advocate that. I mean, that's, you know, but that's, you know. Or allegedly also the knights of shining armor, you know what I mean? The people who had the chivalrous code of ethics, however long that lasted, a couple hundred years, I don't know.
The Shmuel and Shining Armor, as I like to say.
It's Shmuel and Shining Armor, you know. All right. Women like that, you know. Women, that's
to that. He shook you off so hard.
You know. It's about, you know, I think it's an advantage in the world of dating, being chivalrous.
Hasn't worked yet.
Okay.
I'm just being silly now.
All right. So that's what we're talking. That was, you know, Avram and views on modern romance. That was the point of the class. So everything in good measure. But really, as you see from Rabbi Kiva's statement, really the goal is to not just have a relationship, but to have a relationship which has a godliness about it, where there's a goal where the couple's working together to really go beyond themselves, to create a home of excellence, of kindness, of compassion, of ideas, of education. That's what a Jewish home is all about. Yeah, romance is a part of it, but it's not the ideal. It's not the ultimate ideal. All right, guys, have a great night. I'll see many of you tomorrow. And we'll pick it up same time, same bat station next Tuesday night. All the best, guys.
Thanks, Rabbi.
Oh, thank you.
You're well. Bye.
Thank you.